Welcome to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. I'm Christopher Keneally for Velocity of Content. It's Friday, June 18th, 2021. Today, as we do each week, we check in with Publishers Weekly on news from the world of books and publishing. And Robin East, BW Senior Writer, joins me with his reporting and analysis. Welcome back to the program, Andrew.
Hey there, Chris.
So this week, Andrew, best-selling author and former Trump administration national security advisor John Bolton is back in the news. The Department of Justice has announced it will end legal proceedings brought against Bolton last year while President Trump was still in office. The decision means Bolton gets to keep the financial proceeds earned from his memoir, The Room Where It Happened.
Yeah, and he gets to stay out of jail, too. So good news for John Bolton, who a year to the day after the suit was first filed against him, finally has his clearance to publish his memoir. But for the rest of us, I think the news isn't quite as good as it could be, or at least needs to be, at least not yet. But we'll do the news first. As you say, after a year of litigation, the U.S. Department of Justice dropped its civil and criminal legal actions against former National Security Advisor John Bolton over the best-selling memoir, The Room Where It Happened. The news came in a brief two-line stipulation that was filed on June 16th, in which federal judge Royce Lamberth dismissed the DOJ case against Bolton with prejudice and ordered each side to pay their own fees and costs. Our listeners will recall that last year, DOJ officials sued to block publication of Bolton's memoir, alleging that it contained classified information that jeopardized national security and that it ran afoul of Bolton's non-disclosure agreements, which explicitly required the author to await a written clearance from government reviewers before going ahead and publishing his book. But after waiting for months for that clearance, Bolton and his publisher, Simon & Schuster, decided that something was going on, and that they were just going to go ahead with publication, this after a couple of postponed pub dates already. Now, in court, listeners will recall that Lamberth, without having read the book or really heard all the facts, actually chided Bolton for publishing the book without a written clearance and suggested that he probably did jeopardize national security. But he refused to block publication because that's just not what we do here in America, at least not yet. Democracy requires care, of course. And the Trump DOJ then decided to pursue a really bitter civil suit to seize Bolton's royalties. He was paid a $2 million advance. And they even initiated a criminal investigation of Bolton. Now, Bolton, on the other hand, insisted from the outset that the book was not in violation of any agreement and that it was cleared by government reviewers before political appointees in the Trump administration stepped in and, to quote his term, misused the review process to suppress a book that would potentially embarrass the president. Indeed, court filings revealed the lengthy, intensive government review process, including there was a bombshell letter filed with the court by attorneys for one Ellen Knight, who was the National Security Council official who led the pre-publication review of Bolton's book. And in that 19-page letter, Ellen Knight bolstered the author's claims of bad faith and confirmed that the book was indeed cleared, only to be blocked by political appointees who later unsuccessfully pressured Ellen Knight to change her story, and then they eventually removed her from her post when she resisted, so says Ellen Knight. In a statement, Bolton's lawyer Charles Cooper said the decision to end the litigation against Bolton was a complete vindication and that it did suggest wrongdoing by the Trump DOJ. I'll quote Charles Cooper here. By ending these proceedings, the Department of Justice has tacitly acknowledged that President Trump and his White House officials acted illegitimately, Cooper said in a statement.
And of course, this case would have likely gone very differently had Trump won re-election. I gather, Andrew, that's why you say the news is good for Bolton, but not yet good for the rest of us.
That's exactly right. You know, and I pointed out last year that this litigation would probably simmer along until after the election. And if Trump won, well, it would continue. And if Trump lost, it would probably be dropped. Now, I should add that I fully believe Bolton would have been vindicated in the courts had Trump won and decided to still pursue the case. One of the heartening things I think we saw over the last 4 years of norm breaking and other signs of political malfeasance is that Trump's bullshit, shall we say, for lack of a better term, always seemed to hit the wall when it got to court. And I do believe that the same would have happened here. And in that sense, you know, I kind of wish this case had continued because the two sides were set to present evidence about Bolton's claims of bad faith in the review process. But now with the litigation dismissed, it's unclear whether Bolton's claims of bad faith by the government in this process are just going to go away, or maybe they're going to get looked at more by an inspector general. But something needs to happen here. Now, I'm not a huge fan of John Bolton, but Bolton and his publishers have done a service here, I think, by bringing this to light. And this is far from the first time that publishers have accused and authors have accused the government of using the government review process to suppress controversial viewpoints or disclosures. Again, our listeners may recall, we've talked about it briefly on this show, that in April of 2019, the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University and the ACLU sued the government seeking more transparency regarding various government agencies' pre-publication book review processes. And let's face it, not every author has the profile of John Bolton. And this kind of interference probably scuttles a lot more books and a lot more disclosures that we as citizens should probably have. You know, we deserve a review process that is transparent and predictable. And I really do fear that if we just let the Bolton case here kind of fade away without addressing the larger issue of how the review process can be used to sort of systematically block public information from being released, well, then we will have wasted an opportunity.
New York State has now become the second state to pass an ebook access law for libraries, Andrew. Maryland was the first state with such legislation earlier this spring.
That's right. You know, start spreading the news. New York is now the second state to pass a bill that would ensure public libraries the right to license and lend ebooks that are available to consumers in the state. This after six votes on successive days in the Assembly and the Senate last week. The bill crossed the finish line just before the June 10th close of the legislative session in New York, and it's now headed to New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's desk. And as you know, if signed, the law would be the second such piece of legislation following Maryland's. Like the Maryland legislation, that officially became law on June 1, the New York bills require publishers who offer to license ebooks to the public to also offer to license those ebooks to libraries on, quote, reasonable terms. And the bill's summary states that the law is designed to ensure, prohibit harmful practices that discriminate against libraries and harm library patrons. And also, like the Maryland legislation, New York's bill passed unanimously in the Assembly. So a couple of things to note about the New York bill. First, New York was the second bill to pass. Maryland was first. But the New York library ebook law could actually take effect before Maryland's because by statute, Maryland's law doesn't take effect until January of 2022, while the New York legislation would go into effect just 19 days after it's signed into law. And the second thing I guess that brings up is when will it be signed into law or will it be signed into law? And we're told that that could happen at any moment. That could happen while we're recording. But here's how the process works. In New York, the governor has 10 days to sign or veto a bill if that bill was passed during the legislative session, which this bill was. And if the governor doesn't sign or veto the bill within that allotted 10-day time frame, then the bill automatically becomes law. But the wild card here is exactly when the bill is going to be delivered to the governor for signature. The law must be presented for signing before the end of the calendar year, but legislators do have some discretion as to when to send the bill to the governor's desk. And it's common practice in New York to hold a bunch of bills together and then send them along in packages for the governor's signature. Now, will the governor sign it? Jeremy Johansson, who's the executive director of the New York Library Association, told me he was, and I'll quote him here, absolutely cautiously optimistic that Cuomo is going to sign the bill, citing the overwhelming strength of the vote count. But he said, until it's signed, it's not signed, and New York librarians are going to continue to advocate.
In your online story for PW, Andrew, you reported that a dash of last-minute drama went into the sausage-making for this bill.
Yeah, so the passage of both the New York and the Maryland bills came despite opposition from the Association of American Publishers, which filed testimony in Maryland in March claiming that its library ebook law ran afoul of federal copyright law and is unconstitutional. And they continue to maintain that the New York bill as well is also unconstitutional. And, you know, just days before the bills passed in Maryland and in New York, the New York Library Association sent out a tweet and put a campaign up on social media asking library supporters to contact their legislators after discovering that, and I'll quote them here, a well-known lobbying firm was advocating against the law. And in response, NYLA's New York Library Association's Jeremy Johansson said that his grassroots base of library advocates generated more than 5,000 emails in the last 3 days of the legislative session, which, again, I think suggests that Governor Cuomo has little reason to veto this bill, right? I mean, it passed the Assembly unanimously, and it generated a torrent of support in the final days of the session. So think it's fair to say the law is popular. Now, what happens next? We will see. I'm told that several states are advancing similar legislation, so we'll keep an eye on that. And one last thing here, you know, these laws are being, you know, celebrated by library advocates and obviously opposed by the AAP on copyright grounds. But I want to give you a hot take from me that is probably going to satisfy no one on either side of this. And that's that, you know, the laws in practice are just not that impactful. You know, on the publisher side, most publishers already comply with the law. You know, they provide access to licenses to ebooks for libraries that I think are surely legally reasonable, at least in terms of what the law requires. And on the flip side, these bills don't give libraries anything that they don't already have, which is basic access. Now, that the bills codify basic access for libraries, I think is important. I know the library community believes that is important, absolutely. But as we've discussed on this show for some time, there are some big issues facing libraries and publishers in the digital library market post-pandemic, and these bills really don't impact any of that. So I think they're a development worth talking about, but I just don't see them as having an impact either on publishers or the libraries at this moment.
And finally, HarperCollins CEO Brian Murray has been talking about the good fortunes of the publishing market.
Yeah, you could read all about that on the Publishers Weekly site. My editor, Jim Milliot, covered the presentation, which was part of Credit Suisse's 23rd annual communications conference. And, you know, just as you say, HarperCollins CEO Brian Murray told people at the conference that he sees no signs of consumer book spending slowing down in 2021, nor does he see the trend toward greater consolidation of the publishing industry cooling off either. Murray reported that consumer research conducted by HarperCollins found that book buying should remain strong for the rest of the year. So that's good news. He speculated that book purchasing has reached sort of a new gear. We've sort of hit a new level. Also great news. And Murray said that Harper is also being very aggressive in buying new books to ensure that the publisher gets, quote, its share of the larger pie. And that's great news for authors. The more thorny thing that Murray talked about is that, you know, he mentioned that scale matters in publishing in terms of a company's ability to compete. And this is with both tech platforms, he said, as well as to reinvest in its business. And Murray closed the session by saying that all signs point to more consolidation in the industry and added that HarperCollins will be, quote, active in that regard. So, you know, we're already poised to see the top six publishers become the top four. I think this is something to probably watch going forward, that, you know, more consolidation in the publishing industry could be forthcoming.
Well, whether it's Big Six, Big Five, Big Four, you're the tops with us. Andrew Albanese, Publishers Weekly senior writer, thank you for joining me today on the program and every week on the podcast.
My pleasure, as always.
Our recording engineer today is Rob Simon of Burst Marketing. You can subscribe to the program wherever you go for podcasts and follow us on Twitter and Facebook. I'm Christopher Keneally. Thanks for listening. Join us again soon for another Velocity of Content podcast from CCC.